and we won't have to cry no more.
Welcome to Tavern In, y'all,
a weekly podcast about the stories we share while on pilgrimage as queer Catholics. I'm Jacob Flores, and I am running solo here in Dallas. Well, you, Pat, where are you?
I am in Des Moines, Iowa, very far from home.
That's not that far, is it?
Well, I'm surrounded by corn, which I think it amplifies the loneliness.
Are you going to turn into a child of the corn?
If you build it, they will come.
Oh, wow.
Which sounds creepy when you say it right after Children of the Corn. That was an uplifting movie. But anyway, I'm his husband, Patrick Flores, and I missed y'all last week. Everybody, sorry we didn't upload an episode. There's a lot going on in the world, and we got kind of distracted and busy, and we weren't able to put anything out. So sorry about that. But we are on episode 32. Does that seem crazy, Jacob?
Yes, that seems very crazy. 32 seems like a lot.
It's a lot. It's also maybe a good time to kind of like land the plane for a little bit,
right?
Refuel, you know, stretch our legs, remember what it's like to walk on the ground.
Have our week Tuesday nights back.
Oh, that'd be amazing. We usually record on Tuesday nights, y'all, so Tuesday nights are you know, they're busy.
Just kidding, we love y'all. Yeah, so we thought it'd be a good time to end the season, and so with that being said, we invited Zinzi and Patrick Weston, our lovely comrades, to chat about the season and what's going on in the world right now.
Yeah, so we had an awesome conversation with them. We know that there is a lot to recap from season one, and also just a lot going on as far as the uprisings, and you know, just trying to figure out how we can meet the moment well as an organization that is dedicated to bringing about justice and change, and you know, not trying to just be insulated from all the stuff that's going on in the world. So also at the end of this episode, we're going to give you all a little hint as to some of the changes that we're going to be making in season two. We've got big plans and we're really excited about it.
I have a question.
Yes.
How do you feel about having completed a full season of Tabard In?
It feels a little bit surreal because I didn't think that, one, I didn't think we'd ever have a podcast. Mm-hmm. I remember that getting tossed out at the very beginning of Vine and Fig and feeling like that would be maybe a waste of time, but certainly something that like there was plenty of in the world. We didn't need another podcast, and we certainly didn't need a couple of more cis gay guys hosting a queer Christian podcast. Like there was plenty out there.
Wow.
So I don't know. It feels it's satisfying, but also it feels very bizarre to be like, wow, this is a thing that we have done and are doing now.
Yeah. Cause how many episodes did you do in total for the first season?
Oh, way to put me on the spot.
Over 30?
Yeah, we're right at 30, I believe.
That's amazing.
This might be 32 when it comes out.
Right. Congratulations, guys. I'm very proud of you.
Thank you.
Have you guys heard the joke of what do you call a group of two or more millennials? And the answer is a podcast. So I always...
Oh, that is so... I had not heard that one before. That's very funny.
Yeah, it's one of my favorites.
Yeah.
There's something deeply, I don't know if it's therapeutic, but I find it, I'm more and more okay with the idea that there's just going to be so many podcasts out there and that they're not all going to be professionally done. And like, it's nice to kind of have a space that's media where folks can really share. And it's not like there's no big commercial. It's not like NBC. It's not like a big TV show or movie or anything. Like it's much more, it's more than like a tweet, but it's also a lot less than a massive, you know, production. And there's absolutely no budget. It's like just a handful of people talking because they want to. And then if anyone wants to listen in, be a part of our conversation.
Yeah, I really love that too. It kind of scared me in the beginning when I started thinking about doing a podcast. And the more I think about it, the more I'm comfortable with you know, people just kind of going off into their own community and then joining a podcast and having sort of like a fandom around it. It's definitely a trend that you see in user experience design, where people are very much aware that we no longer have to cater to the globe. We can just cater to the people who want to find us and make sure that they can find us.
Yeah, so, absolutely. Yeah.
I think that's one of my favorite things about the podcast is just how, I don't know, authentic it feels. I guess I also know both of you personally, so it kind of feels like I'm listening to friends talk, which I appreciate. But I feel like that authenticity around, I don't know, just being really real about your lives and the stories that you share with other folks as well is, I don't know, something that really draws me in, and I feel like draws other people in as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I totally agree with that. What are you feeling, Jacob? Are you also proud? What are you looking back on now that we're doing this last episode of the season?
I don't think I'm looking back on anything. I'm just excited to jump into the next round of it.
Nice.
No, it was fun. I agree with Pat. I didn't think that it was going to be really a thing, but just goes to show that you don't know until you try.
Right.
Can I ask how you all decided to stop your season?
Yeah.
Like, where'd you draw that line?
We just ran out of steam and we decided to stop. No, I'm just kidding.
That's totally valid though, too.
I mean, maybe it was a bit of that, but it was more of a conversation that, you know, Zinzi and Jacob were bringing a lot of ideas to like how we could reinvigorate the podcast and tweak some things that maybe aren't working as well. And we kind of realized, well, maybe we need to like pause and figure out, all right, how are we going to do that? And test it out a little bit. And the ideas that we have going forward are going to be a little more time intensive. So it's worth pausing and actually doing that well. And so a lot of it, I think, just came down to like, maybe this is a good point to stop and say, we're going to recalibrate and then go forward. We're going to be even better. Hmm. Yeah, we did a shift, you know, a couple of months ago to focusing more on storytelling and less on current events. Yeah. And I think it was a good shift because it allowed us to really, you know, say we want to listen to people's stories and who they really are and get to know them more. But one of the downsides of it is that an episode can kind of just drag on as you're listening to one person kind of, you know, talk to for 45 minutes to an hour. And we want to do a better job going forward talking about using storytelling and a person's perspective, but fitting it within a bigger topic. Mm-hmm. And so that's a big thing that we're going to be doing in season two.
What's your favorite episode from season one?
We'll only answer it if both of you do as well.
Yeah, definitely. Pickles, go ahead.
Oh, I see how it is. I get put on the spot now. Let's see. I'm going through the list of episodes. Trying to see. I was going to be like, episode with Zinzi.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I don't know. I feel that's a great question. I like the episode with Michael O'Loughlin a lot, both because it inspired me to then listen to his podcast. Mm. And the stories are all really powerful. I don't know. I enjoy them all. I really do.
I'm going to say the one with Dorothy Fortenberry.
Oh.
There was just an excitement that she had when she was on, and she touched on not a lot of different topics, but kind of a really general topic that pretty much any listener can get behind and not feel like, oh, I have no idea what they're talking about, or I'm not of that narrative or experience.
I do love the episodes that are able to hit have a good conversation about being an outsider within the Catholic Church. I think that that's a general theme with most of our guests is feeling that way. But Dorothy Fortenberry did a wonderful job with it. I think my personal favorite is going to come as no big surprise was Rosemary Mahoney, because she is my favorite author. And it was astonishingly cool to be able to have a conversation with her. And
we're continuing having conversations with her, which is nice.
Yeah, absolutely. That's and amazing. And so having the, somebody who is probably in no small part a reason that I'm still within the Catholic Church, and then being able to have a conversation about my own, struggles and finding a place in it, and just it was really neat for me. And I don't know if anybody else was able to get something out of it, but for me that was a really powerful conversation.
That's nice, and so good that you're still speaking with her and learning.
Yeah, it's been really nice to actually have a friendship form out of it. That was not something I expected starting a podcast, was that I'd be able to make friends with some of the guests that we have on, but it's a really nice side benefit. And it also, like, that is one of the directions that we want to take the podcast in with season two, is being maybe less explicitly or exclusively for queer Catholics and more just for Catholics who feel out of place in the church. Like, there's still going to be a big emphasis on queer people and being able to share queer stories, because we think that's so important. But we're also hoping to be a place that others who feel like the Catholic Church needs to do a better job, and they feel like they have a home in the church, but they don't feel completely comfortable there as well.
Like, hopefully Black that, people.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. Hopefully Tabardin can be a place where a lot of folks with different perspectives and backgrounds can share their story and still feel like, we talk about being a pilgrimage themed podcast, and all of us are kind of on the way, on the journey together in the church, and we want to be able to share more stories and learn from each other, because there's a whole lot that we can.
Pat, you often tell me that you wish, so things that we're doing, you tell me you wish that this is something that you had when you were, knee deep in church. In, why am I blanking? In seminary.
In seminary, in youth group, in, right. Absolutely.
And, like, that's a really great way to approach this. And I think, like, what you said earlier was it would be nice to give a glimpse to those who aren't in the church yet, who might have been who had my kind of perspective, where I didn't know what it was like to be in the church and coming from a really secular part of the world. Jesuitical did a really good job for me with that.
Right.
They kind of were, I don't know, my mentors in throughout RCIA, which was really nice. Yep. I think on the other hand, Catholic Church babies can often get too focused in only church issues. And I think that we want to go towards a place where we can share stories that are different from what they're used to.
I like that.
Yeah, there's a lot more to the church than just the intellectual side, the apologetics and convincing others. I think a lot of folks who have had an intellectual journey coming into the Catholic Church, that's what they're most attracted to, because it's what they most had to wrestle with in order to become Catholic. But there's so much more to being Catholic and being able to share some of those experiences, and even just the emotional side of being in the church is equally important to me. Mm-hmm.
I like that. I can't wait until season two comes out.
Well, we're excited that you're going to be helping us out a little bit with it too, because having Zinzi, you already volunteered, so don't act surprised. But to have I know you're going to be doing some of the interviews and definitely helping on the production side of shaping the episodes and making sure that our perspectives are in the right place. And so I'm really excited that you'll be a part of the team for Tabernin as well.
I'm very excited as well.
And you, just dropped a little hint at the beginning of the episode that we need to circle back around to real quick, that you were, you know, thinking about starting a podcast, and you don't have to spill all the beans on that. We'll hold some of our cards until an announcement gets made. But what did you mean, Zinzi?
Well, it aligns perfectly with my favorite episode from season one. I was listening to it earlier, and I was listening specifically for something that Jacob said. Remember the episode about Lent?
Oh, gosh.
Yes.
You were in Florida. There were loud neighbors. There was stomping.
Florida.
Yeah. Somebody was in Florida, and there were loud neighbors. And, I mean, it seems like a century ago, right? When, I mean, I can certainly remember, you know, going on Amazon and finding my perfect little ebook for Lent. And then 2 weeks later, everything changes. So, I mean, for me, Lent is still going, and I'm still not doing anything with it. But so Jacob was saying something really beautiful in that episode. He was talking about how he struggled to kind of feel like a true Catholic, because Catholics can be kind of maybe like insular and is the word exclusionary?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, here you can tell that aside from, you know, queer spirituality, I also need Vine and Fig to brush up on my English. Anyway, so as he was talking about saying something to the effect of having to learn to embrace the way he is a Catholic and shape his own relationship with God, he said, yeah, I learned that I don't have to read the gospel every day, which is definitely something I need to be doing.
Oh, yeah. We started talking about guilt and...
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And... So that's what my podcast is about. And it's specifically about that type of guilt, the guilt that you look at and think, I don't have that, but okay, I should be doing it anyway, but I'm not doing it. But it's still something that's in the back of my head. It's nagging me. Maybe I'm saying this because I want people to understand that I feel guilty, even though I maybe don't, which, if you ask my Jewish partner, is very specific to Catholics. And so my podcast is going to be very short episodes where I interview people about some of the things that make them feel guilty. I'm currently in the process of recording some of the interviews, and yeah, I hope that we'll get to launch this project sometime in the fall.
I can't wait.
I'm so excited about this.
Hey, Zinzi.
Yes.
On three, something you feel guilty about. One, two, three.
My mom.
Okay. I guess we'll have to wait till fall to dive into that then.
Oh, my, yes.
Patrick, can I ask you what, because you're someone who sometimes listens to podcasts, but maybe not quite as much as like Zinzi or I, or even Jacob on some level.
Patrick's dad listens to more podcasts, especially ours, more than he does.
That's probably true.
Wait, did I make you feel guilty?
Yes, you did. Success. Zinzi, I'm ready. Get me on your podcast.
But Patrick, I'm curious what you look for in a podcast, or maybe what you appreciate in a podcast, that when you listen to one and you kind of feel fulfilled, you feel like, you know, you really got something out of it. What happens during a podcast that's kind of unique to that space for you?
No, these are great questions. And I will say my dad listens to more podcasts because he has an hour drive to and from work every day. And I work from home. So we have like very opposite commutes right now. And
these
are
just excuses.
Exactly. No. I don't know. I like shorter episodes that, you know, tell stories. I've never really been able to get into fiction-based podcasts or... what are the ones that are like, there's one that was like kind of like a crime series, Serial. Is that what it was? Serial, super popular. Yeah. Like, I can't get into anything like that.
Missing out. Matthias,
I know, right? Matthias Roberts' Queerology podcast was really the first podcast that I kind of like binged and listened to when I was coming out. I remember I would go on bike rides and I would put headphones in and just listen to it and bike around. And I don't know, hour and a half bike rides and would get through three episodes or something like that.
That's the most Dutch thing you've ever done.
I know, right? Out in the middle of like rural Ohio, just on my bike riding around. But I don't know. I think it was helpful because it was so personal to me. And I feel like that's why I also like listening to your podcast, because it feels particularly relevant in things that I helped start Vine and Fig. But at the same time, like, I don't know a ton of queer Catholics outside of the Vine and Fig organization.
Do you think any of the others do?
Probably. I mean, I don't want to speak for everyone, but probably not a whole lot either. I don't know. Yeah. It just provides community for me. And I think that's what I look for, is that kind of community aspect and feeling. So I think, like I mentioned earlier, the authenticity of it all is really what gets me.
Nice.
That's so beautiful. All right, guys. I guess we've been talking for 20 minutes, 21 minutes. Pat, you matter. Patrick matters. Jacob matters. But also, Black Lives Matter.
Mm-hmm.
I guess this is a very, what's the word? An episode that's very much put in a specific time and in a specific space, maybe more so than any of the others, aside from, of course, Catholic rituals. And I am a Dutch person who has seen people protest in the streets, but I'm sure it's nothing like the US. What's Monday been like? Which is when we're recording this, of course.
Yeah, this will come out on Thursday, but it's a Monday right in the middle of the massive uprising and protests that are going on. And it is a bizarre mix for me, at least, of being incredibly hopeful and having a lot to look at that is beautiful and inspiring, but also knowing that the catalyst for all that is beautiful and inspiring right now is ugly and depressing and just a whole lot of bullshit rearing its head in society right now, at least in the United States, with police brutality, especially against the Black community. And so it's incredible to see so many people out in the streets in a sustained way, but it's also like, it also feels like the culmination of a whole lot of just gross shit that has never changed. So like, you feel like there's the potential for change, but also it feels like this moment has just been building in the worst way.
Right.
My mood is interesting. I keep alternating between trying to do my day job to keep things going, but also feeling this anxiety is maybe not the right word, but this call to be out protesting or to be doing more. And it's hard to kind of segment in my mind and do my day-to-day things, but also trying to devote time to reading the news and educating myself on the issues, and also, just showing up and being there as well. So it's a weird mix for sure.
So, I'm sorry, who was, getting ready to say something?
I was just going to chime in. Patrick, you and I had a conversation, last week, I believe, when I posted what was kind of a general story question on Instagram to those who posted the Blackout Tuesday post, wondering what was their reasoning behind doing so. Was it solidarity? Was it activism? And you made an interesting point where you said that you didn't want to seem performative. And I don't mean to call you out by any means. This isn't calling you out. You said you didn't want to be performative by posting a video of you at the protest, and you said that you had deleted it. You shouldn't worry about being performative. You're out there doing the work. And I think showing that you're out there doing the work will get other people to think, why am I not out there? And I think just showing solidarity in person out on the streets for those who are able-bodied and, you know, have the ability to do so, I think that's kind of the least you could do, in my opinion.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think I've struggled with this for a while of, you know, wanting to be genuine in what I'm doing and, you know, not doing stuff for the feed. And
right.
If that makes sense. And I don't know. I feel like I keep changing my mind on things. And I also think that that's good and acceptable as well. I feel mm-hmm. like we sometimes don't let people change their minds and grow. For example, I did talk to you about the protest, and I was like, I feel weird posting a video of this because it seems like I'm like expecting pats on the back for literally walking in the street in solidarity with these folks, which is, like you said, like one of the low bars or kind of the least that I could be doing. But then I started thinking about, like, on Facebook, I have a bunch of conservative family members that were posting things that I wasn't agreeing with. And I was like, if they're using this as a platform mm-hmm. and are able to kind of spew these ideas, why shouldn't I post myself here showing kind of what I believe and care for? So, and I don't know, I do waffle back and forth around the performative nature of things, but I think we know why we're doing things, right. And I think you're kind of spot on where, like, you know in your heart if you're doing things for the likes or the attention or to look good, or if you're actually doing it because that's something you mm-hmm. believe in. So,
I've got a lot of acquaintances on, I guess, ex-colleagues that are posting on Instagram and Facebook, and it was just the first week. Now they're fully silent on the subject. They keep, all they talked about was, I'm doing my part to educate myself. I'm watching 13th on Netflix. Oh, girl. And that's it. And I'm just like, you just took it to another lower level of what is expected. Like, showing up is one thing, but like just saying that you're learning, but not really putting the work out there mm-hmm. isn't, I don't know. I find it kind of that not only performative, but it falls on deaf ears. I think now, especially with this current situation that we're in, or the kind of the eye opener of George Floyd's death, we're now starting to see and read between the lines of what actions people are taking are actually making moves and change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's I really love that you had this conversation and that you're sharing it with us, because I, of course, have been thinking a lot about, you know, performative wokeness and performative outrage and what we can do to make sure that we send the message that we want to send to people who are not tolerant. And I was at my father-in-law's over the weekend, and he'll never listen to this, so I'm just going to say it. He is the whitest, straightest, cisest man I have ever met, and I work in IT. He is still completely white. He's a very sweet guy, but he is like, so of course we talked about the whole thing that was going on, and he was very adamant about it. He thought that the black screen was amazing. It was very important to him that people were posting that a lot, because at least they were doing something. And I usually hesitate to congratulate white people on the bare minimum, mm-hmm. Because that's exactly the problem. The more people show outrage now and are quiet after this, the more damage it's going to do.
Right.
If you know that you're not going to do what you can to educate yourself, to become anti-racist, then don't even go protest, because it's only going to make, you know, the rest of us feel very hopeful. But he really didn't agree with me. And I really love what Patrick just said about using the space that he shares with his conservative family members as a way to show what he believes. Because there, it could hardly be performative. It's performative when you're talking to an echo chamber of people who kind of, you know, fall into step with what you want and what you think of the world. And I'm sorry, my screen just went black and I thought I had lost my recording.
You're good. You're good.
Dang it. Okay, what was I saying? Help me out.
It wouldn't be performative if it's for folks who, you know, basically don't see eye to eye with you.
Also some cars coming by. Yeah, it posting, you know, a video of yourself at a rally to your conservative family members on Facebook is saying, hey, I am doing something different and you're kind of close to me. Maybe you can listen to my story and learn a little bit. It can be performative if you're talking to an echo chamber on Instagram of people who are all doing the same thing, which is show solidarity now with the Black Lives Matter movement. And I hesitate to say that it's not about solidarity now, because it is. If it weren't for solidarity now, nobody would be in the street. But I think it's more about planning to, you know, do something that's actually going to make a change. And that's not going to be posting on Instagram that we're watching 13th. It's going to be learning from 13th. And I guess implementing it in our lives, right?
There's a, I'm seeing a lot of, and I like that you bring up the echo chamber and speaking to people who are of the same thought. I'm seeing a lot of progressives and liberals also using social media as an arena to discuss what they feel should be the next steps, what policy should be moving forward. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's a really great thing that's kind of new to me, at least. Mm-hmm. I'm seeing people post like, you know, 8 can't wait. And then more people coming in and saying 8 can't wait isn't enough. Mm-hmm. And I'm seeing those nuances.
Can I just ask a question real quick? Mm-hmm. What's the 8 thing?
Basically, it's a series of policy proposals for police departments to reform. A lot of them are, they're very positive. It's a lot of lowest bar, but it's stuff like no chokeholds and things like that that mm-hmm. are... They definitely need to be implemented. I've also, like where Jacob's pointing out, there's some pushback against it, is that a lot of folks are saying, but like the police department in Minneapolis had 7 of 8 of those reforms in place when George mm-hmm. Floyd was killed. So there needs to be a whole lot more than just kind of reforms on paper for the violence and the discrimination and everything that has been plaguing the police departments to actually have an impact in the community. Mm-hmm. So it's a fantastic conversation to be having, because, you know, like we went to the protest in Dallas, and like on the way home, we were listening to the radio, and my dad actually, you know, came with us, and for like, he was able to hear a conversation on the radio about defunding the police and what that would mean. And like, and you could tell like he was really paying attention in a way that I've never, I think had him, you know, really be kind of attuned to what some of the implications of these progressive policies and what it might look like and everything. So it was, the whole conversation, I feel like on so many levels is has moved a light year ahead of where it was just last year.
Yeah.
Nice. That's pretty good. Thank you for explaining.
Absolutely.
You know what I sometimes think about? Maybe it's because I recently watched that special on Netflix, but I think with racism, what we do a lot is we turn one person or one entity into the villain and say, I'm not that, so at least I'm okay. I am not a slave trader, so I'm okay. I am not a cop killing Black people, I'm okay. I am not Hitler, I'm okay. And I kind of feel at this moment that the police, and I know that what they did sparked this moment, and I think it's really important that the reforms that you were just talking about, that, you know, they come into reality one way or another. But at the same time, I kind of feel like the police are currently the Epstein of racism, the way Epstein suddenly kind of became the worst and only, you know, pedophile we could think of, when in reality, mm-hmm. there's like this whole system around people like him who enable stuff like that. How can we look at the situation and realize that it's not just about the police, but about society as a whole that kind of enables this behavior?
That's a very great question. And I feel like I share your sentiments, where it's, you know, education and healthcare and transit access and just all sorts of things for different communities that are kind of causing problems here and people are being overlooked. But I don't know how we get there. Obviously, people are, you know, suggesting and encouraging folks to vote for candidates who kind of have better positions on these issues. And I think that's totally valid. But I feel like sometimes even voting for progressive candidates doesn't quite result in the action that is necessary or is needed as well. So,
right.
And it's one of those things where when you have a topic that has been so vilified, and rightly so, to say, you know, racism is horrendous, that it makes it maybe hard for folks to own up to it when mm-hmm. they have been that way. And so it's hard, like, if we were to have a conversation around speeding, you're mm-hmm. when you're driving your car, I think a lot of folks would feel comfortable saying, yeah, I know generally speaking it's wrong, but like I can have a conversation. They would own up to some of the times that they've done it and been able to say, okay, how can I be better going forward? How can I be a safer driver? Mm-hmm. But with something like racism, like, it's not only are we very ill-equipped because we don't have the conversations, we haven't traditionally had the conversations mm-hmm. to be able to identify it within our own lives, but also it's kind of put on such a level that I think most folks feel like, if I were to ever do it, like, would I ever have it? If I were to own up to it, would I ever be able to find a job again, type thing? Mm-hmm. Like, it's,
yeah.
And so I think part of it is finding ways to especially have a conversation with white people to be able to say, like, it's okay to own up with it so that you can own up to it so that you can learn from mm-hmm. it and move forward. Because if you just assume that you've never done it because you don't want to look at it, mm-hmm. then like you can't ever get better and you'll never recognize the times that you are in an ongoing way mm-hmm. still racist.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really I think about this a lot, the fact that in at least in the West post World War II, we've come to see it as so normal that we can look at an event or like an entire period in history and think to ourselves, oh, we'd never want to be like that, and decide that we can't be like that. If you look at how, you know, this kind of developed over time with, for example, anti-Semitism, people were so scared of being equated to Hitler that no matter what they said, they would always be able to say, I'm not anti-Semitic. I have a Jewish neighbor. And it's, of course, the same with, you know, any type of ethnic minority. You know, people are so obsessed with not being called a racist that they forget how obsessed I, as a brown person, am with not being called the N-word.
Right, right. We become so comfortable as a society that we, like you said, we forget, and look at where we are now. We have white supremacists and KKK members showing up in offices and you know, publicly marching through the streets, creating mm-hmm. fear. Yeah, you make a really good point.
Yeah.
Pat, Zinzi, you brought up a good point about cops being kind of the poster boy, poster child of what we shouldn't be. Mm-hmm. Pat, isn't there something in Catholic moral teachings about levels of goodness and how we can't just strive to not be bad, that we have to be
interesting,
good, like better?
Hmm.
Yes. I'm not sure.
I'm looking through my notes from RCIA and I can't find it. But that Zinzi, what Zinzi said reminded me of that. And the sister who was running those RCIA sessions that I was in, she said, she was talking about how, you know, Catholics are called to be good, be wholly good, and not just make excuses for doing the bare minimum and saying, well, at least I'm not Hitler.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, there's definitely a longstanding teaching that like neutrality is not good, that mm-hmm. Merely not doing evil is not the same thing as being a good person and actively being a force for good in the world, which as Christ-inspired people we are called to be. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's absolutely a foundational piece of Catholic moral teaching.
Could we maybe have some show notes if you can find any reading on that? Because I would love to know more about that.
Yeah, there's another philosopher. I don't believe he was Catholic or religious in any way, but he also had ideas of levels of goodness. I'll find it.
Cool.
So what can we do as an organization to be, to better meet the moment, to be more intersectional, and to be a place that is able to stand up for justice kind of in all its forms, not just, you know, on behalf of the few and the most privileged in our cohort.
What do you got, Pickles?
I'm thinking. I'm not really sure. I appreciate the community for having these conversations. And I know I like posted something about the 8 can't wait, and somebody posted something else about like, hey, this might not be completely the solution and things need to take it a little further. And I don't know, having the community there and, you know, other folks chiming in with their ideas is helpful. But I also think that the RCIA But Gay has been really interesting, kind of that column that Mike is doing in teaching folks about our history and educating us on certain groups as well. So I feel like both of those have been helpful. But I'm not sure. I'm curious to hear everyone else's thoughts around ways.
I have a really nice idea. I have a really interesting, concrete idea of how we can contribute to a better society as Vine and Fig. I used to run this meetup in Amsterdam. It was called QPOC Reading Club. And I would get together with queer people of color and we would read things together. And so I studied literature. And because of that, I usually like to steer clear from books as much as I can. So I like to read different kinds of things, like, you know, like poems, essays, but also maybe the TV guide or TV shows, movies, interviews, like kind of like the, you know, the way you could read an object or read somebody to filth, which is not what I'm referring to. something that I realized over these past, what has it been now, 13 days of protest, is that I'm tired as a brown person, but I am not half as tired as Black people in the United States right now. And my philosophy has always been, if you see something that's wrong and you know of a way to help and you're not too tired to help, you should do it. So I would really like to start a Vine and Fig reading club, where we get together maybe once a month, do a nice video call. If you don't want to show your face, that's fine too. And I kind of want to do, you know, comparative analysis of two different things. For example, remember that letter that James Baldwin wrote to his nephew? Maybe read that with, I don't know.
From Paris?
It's from the, it was published in the New York Times, I think, at the time. And it's currently sold in a book called The Fire Next Time. And that's also a quote from that letter. So, you know, maybe read that with like Job 38 or something, and kind of compare and contrast, see what we find, see how it can help us, see how it can help us elevate our ideas of what it means to be, in this case, Black and struggling. I really want to kind of investigate what that could do for us as a community, because I see so many people who want to help, who want to do things beyond, you know, work to change regulations and go out to vote, but who also kind of don't know what's next aside from watching 13th and maybe like reading a couple books. And I think learning to be anti-racist isn't just reading the book, but it's applying what you have learned from the book to a conversation to see how it works. So yeah, maybe you guys want to join me for that. It could be fun.
I'm in.
Absolutely. I'm very excited for reading club.
The Woo! Library is open.
Yes, it is. That's tough.
Zinzi, I feel like you make a great point, though. I feel like if you're picking up any like hobby or training for a race or something, you can't just read or educate. You also have to apply it and practice it. And I think that's really key. I like that framing, and I'm going to steal that for myself when I think through these things.
I know one area I want to focus on is, which I've tried to tackle on a number of occasions, and I just need to stick with it so I can get deeper. But I really want to try and understand liberation theology more. I feel like so many of the communities that I have learned to look up to that have kept their Christianity as a core piece of it have been able to, as marginalized communities, they've been inspired by liberation theology, queer liberation theology, feminist liberation theology, Black liberation theology. Like there seems to be so much there. And like I've tried, you know, reading some of the original texts, which can be kind of dense. And so I'd love if anybody out there has some recommendations on getting more into liberation theology and how it can impact our faith and the way that it inspires a lot of marginalized communities. Please, you know, send us an email or something like that, because that's an area that I'd really love to explore more. I think it seems to have a lot of depth to it that I think we could learn from.
Lovely. Mike Mortimer, we're talking to you, by the way. That's a good idea. I like that.
And Pat wants to understand liberation theology a little more beyond me stomping around the apartment screaming queer liberation theology.
When I was reading some of my queer liberation theology books, Jacob would just yell randomly, "Queer liberation theology!" Love
it. It's so good that you brought this up, because I've been very excited to dive deeper into liberation theology. And what usually happens is I'll be Googling, and because, you know, I'm no longer in academia, so I don't have any access to the good stuff. And
JSTOR,
I'll be Googling. Yeah. And what usually happens, and I don't know if you've experienced this, but it's very easy within Christian internet to be Googling something positive only to fall into the trap of some website. And like 10 minutes later, I'm crying.
Yeah.
I experienced a lot of that when I was going through RCIA, and I would ask Pat questions like, why doesn't St. James do mass facing east? And he would just be like, you need to stop going online to these traditional Catholic websites. I'm like, but it doesn't seem traditional.
Mm-hmm. And I'd be like, you are very deep in a very dark hole right now. We need to bring you out into the sunlight.
But I'm serious. I think, you know, with Fine and Fig, and you know, the way people usually find us, what we can see when, you know, people sign up, I am fully convinced that so many of us struggle for years because we can't find the right spots on the internet where the queer affirming Christians are hanging out. And like the other day, I think I was Googling, Christianity and intersectionality. And I lost a whole day. It was terrible. And I mean, at least it's good that we're now here and people can actually find us and, you know, hear as we kind of listen along as we say positive things about stuff.
That is one of my hopes for season two. I kind of hinted at it earlier that it would be a place for disaffected Catholics in general, not just the queer ones. And I hope that, you know, maybe a revamped version of season two that looks a little bit broader into the perspectives of Catholicism will be a place that can bring together a lot of those folks who feel very siloed and separated in the church right now, so that a lot of the sharing and listening and learning what works to survive but also improve the church can kind of come out into the daylight a lot more.
That's nice. Yeah.
Well, my friends, it has been a lovely afternoon chatting with all of you.
Afternoon. I think it's almost 11 p.m.
Listen, Europe. I do appreciate very much that you stayed up very late to talk with us, because
always.
There's no way I could record a podcast that late at night. I'm such a I die at 10 p.m.
Oh yeah, me. I'm a lesbian, so I die at 8 p.m. You know how we are. Thank you for a wonderful first season, guys, and I'm really excited to work on season two with you.
Absolutely. And we are so excited for your podcast coming out this fall.
Ooh, me too. I actually want to interview all of you. Is that okay? Can we do that?
I think if you do, you're going to learn, you're going to see new perspectives, or not new perspectives. You'll see new levels of each one of us.
That's the whole point.
Know about.
Mm-hmm. That's a goal. Yay.
Patrick is actually a bad boy. Bad boy Midwest.
I mean,
from Ohio.
Yeah, he looks very fair, guys, but
don't give my episode away, everyone.
Come on. All right, Zinzi, go to bed. Get some good sleep.
Yes.
And I'll see y'all on Slack.
Yeah, and see you all next season.
Tabardin is a podcast by Vine and Fig, an affirming community and resource for queer Catholics. And get ready, all, because season two is going to be incredible. We're super excited about our plans. We are going to move to having multiple guests per episode and kind of tackling one big topic per episode. So instead of having one guest that just kind of comes on and talks the entire time, which we've had great conversations on season one, we're really excited to dive deeper into some of the really pressing topics that are going on in the world and in our church and in our lives as queer people.
So be on the lookout for announcements about season two. You can find us on social media at Vine and Fig Co. and on our website at vineandfig.co.
And you can support the podcast by donating to Vine and Fig on Patreon or by leaving a review for Tabardin on Apple Podcasts. That's it for us this season on Tabardin. Thanks for listening, y'all.
Bye forever.